Welcome to this Tuesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Glad that you are with us today. My thanks to Eric Dethridge for filling in the hosting chair of Main Street while I was with family and friends during the holiday. We have a packed show ahead today. Coming up in just a bit, Dr. Tom Easern revisits the eerie folk ballad Frozen Charlotte, tracing how a grim song, a made-up newspaper tale, and a tiny porcelain keepsake blend history with dark humor. We'll also look at hemp's modern resurgence and the federal policy that could abruptly shut down its most profitable markets. And we begin Main Street today with our friend, historian, author, and speaker, Dr. Michael Patrick Cullinane, the Walton Chair of Theodore Roosevelt Studies at Dickinson State University. He's a leading voice in American history. Michael has written extensively on Theodore Roosevelt, United States foreign policy, and how the past shapes our present. And while we had originally planned to review President Trump's first year back in office and look ahead to 2026 and use his historical lens to help us with that, we're going to save that conversation maybe for another time and instead discuss President Trump's role in recent events in Venezuela and what may lie ahead. Dr. Cullinane, welcome back to Main Street.
Thanks for having me, Craig. We have so much to discuss.
We do, and Happy New Year to you, of course. Before we get into Venezuela, put today's news for us in context, if you will. U.S. presidents use force abroad without a declaration of war. What historical playbook are they usually drawing from?
Oh, the history of American military use abroad without congressional approval is extensive. I mean, we can go back to any number of events, probably the most significant being Korea in 1950 to 53. That was probably one of the most sweeping. I mean, without question, a war, right? But we called it a police action. Vietnam, there was no declaration of war, but Congress did approve Lyndon Johnson's use of force. And the same could be said for Iraq in 2003, when a joint resolution of Congress allowed Bush to go to war, the global war on terror, we can call it, right? So there are lots of examples of this. I think the Venezuela example is probably more akin to 35 years ago when the United States under George H.W. Bush invaded Panama and extracted the president Panama, Manuel Noriega. And when they took Noriega, the charges were very similar, although the charges against Noriega against narco trafficking were legitimate. The charges against Maduro and narco trafficking are very flimsy. They're much more like the charges that George W. Bush made against Saddam Hussein in 9/11.
Through this historical lens, are those the only instances in United States history where we've captured a sitting foreign leader and then wanted to try them in the United States?
Those are the two most prominent examples. There are other cases where the United States has ousted military leaders. We can go back to Woodrow Wilson's time and we can think about the overthrow of two Mexican governments. We could go back to the Eisenhower era and look at the overthrow of Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran or the overthrow of Jacobo Arbenz in Guatemala. But it is rare that the United States deposes a head of state in the manner that they've done to Maduro. And it makes for the precedent. I mean, I think Trump is relying on the precedent of Noriega, really, that this has happened before so it can happen again. But the reality is that Panama is a very different country from Venezuela. Venezuela is large. It has 15% of the world's oil reserves. It is not a country that the United States has a long history of nation building in, whereas in Panama, of course, the 100-year history of the Panama Canal is a very long history of nation building from the very revolution to where we are today. It's a different story, and therefore the precedent will be different. I mean, I don't know how Congress or the Supreme Court will react to the United States ruling, as Trump said, Venezuela.
What is the framing of this as a law enforcement operation rather than an invasion or an act of war do politically?
Well, by calling it a law enforcement operation, and obviously by bringing Maduro to a court in the United States to charge him for crimes, it has the air of legitimacy that this is something that, you know, it has the sort of rule of law backing behind it. But, you know, when the United States tried to assassinate Castro in the Bay of Pigs incident and in the 1960s, there were laws that were passed that forbid the United States from assassinating foreign leaders. But there are no laws to stop the United States from basically kidnapping foreign leaders and accusing them of crimes if they try them in a court of law. And so, I mean, the problem with this is it looks an awful lot like a show trial. They're going to put Maduro up on charges of narco-terrorism. All of the evidence suggests that, yes, drugs go through Venezuela, but nowhere near on the scale that Trump is talking about. And yet, they're going to try him on that. The reality is here is that, and Trump has talked about this, that the oil industry is something that is most coveted by this administration. And they say that this is going to pay for the reconstruction of Venezuela and the support of the Venezuelan people. I think that is a very dubious reason to go in and invade a country and to take its leader.
Just, we were set up for this. We've seen these sequential blasting of these boats that allegedly have drugs for weeks. Here's one. Here's another one. Here's another one. All right, now we have to do this. Our hand has been forced, when really, you're right, oil seems to be the end play. And I think the president has even acknowledged that. Before we go deeper, Dr. Cullinane, let me widen the lens a little bit. We've also heard renewed talk in recent years about, especially since President Trump has come back into office, about United States' interest in Greenland. And from a historical standpoint, how should we understand that rhetoric? And is there any precedence for the United States asserting control over a territory like Greenland in the modern era, a NATO partner of sorts?
No, not in the contemporary, not after World War II. No, there's nothing like this. I mean, in 1949, the United States signed the North Atlantic Treaty, which created NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which is basically a defense pact between almost all of Western Europe, Turkey, the United States, Canada. I mean, this alliance is the security that underpins the Atlantic Alliance after World War II. It's also the thing that guarantees prosperity for Europe and North America. Without this security agreement, both the United States and the Europeans are in big trouble. Financially, economically, but also, security-wise, the potential with Greenland is a fracturing of the global order. And really, this is tied into Venezuela, because if the United States decides that the Western Hemisphere is purely under its sort of suzerain control, that what that also means is that Russia might say, my sphere of influence is Ukraine, and China might say, my sphere of influence includes Taiwan. And that might be what the world is getting to. And I think what we're seeing here, and I wonder what people in 1933 thought when they were watching Nazi Germany take over parts of the Sudetenlands and Czechoslovakia. There's a slow creep of territorial aggrandizement that happened then, and it's happening now. And the United States talks about Venezuela, when it talks about Greenland, when it talks about other locations that it wants control over. Other big countries are doing the same thing. And I think we're back to a grand strategy for U.S. foreign policy. And I think the Russians and the Chinese are looking at the world in the same way. And small states are going to get squeezed.
Walk us through how the U.N. Security Council has now reacted to this.
Well, the U.N. Security Council, right, it really doesn't matter what the U.N. Security Council decides to say or do, because the United States has veto control over the Security Council. So we've seen that Russia and China have come out. Also, they have veto power as well. They have come out and said that the taking of Maduro and the trial of Maduro is a sham. We've heard from France and the UK, who are also permanent members on the Security Council, come out and say now that this is not adhering to international law. And also, both of those countries have come out very strongly against Trump in relation to his threats to Greenland. So there is no support from permanent members on the Security Council for the capture of Maduro. And right, let's put this into context, right? Maduro is a dictator who basically fixed the elections in 2024. The world knows that. The European Union does not recognize the government of Nicolas Maduro. But what they do recognize is that international law forbids countries from aggressively ousting governments that don't agree with them. So I think that the United States, while it doesn't matter what happens in the Security Council, because the U.S. can veto any resolution about Venezuela, it does matter that the four other permanent members of the Security Council are pretty much in lockstep in opposing the administration's decision here.
mega and this action seems to me to be not one and the same. Yet mega, as we're the Make America Great Again movement, we're told by the president, is totally in line with what's happened here in Venezuela. What are your thoughts about the mega movement and now what's happened on foreign soil?
Yeah, this is fascinating. I mean, I was watching the press conference the morning after the abduction of Maduro. And one of the questions that I thought was the most provocative, I mean, there were so many questions to Trump. And in fairness to the president, he answered all of them as forcefully and bluntly as he does most reporters. But the one that I think may have startled him the most was the reporter who asked, how is this America first, right? I mean, the oil isn't American, it's Venezuelan. Does it serve American interests? The MAGA movement put Donald Trump in the White House in part because he opposed foreign wars and said that he was going to put America first. And interestingly, what we've seen over the last year of Donald Trump's tenure is that things that are important to Americans, like the price of groceries, and Trump hasn't been able to solve that problem. And so instead, he's taking a playbook out of past presidents. I'm thinking of the Wag the Dog movie where, you know, it's a fictional movie, but it has some relevance to the Clinton administration. When Clinton was feeling pressure domestically, you know, he got involved in Kosovo. And in some ways, this does feel a little bit like, you know, don't pay attention to the man behind the curtain. There's this much bigger thing going on that you need to pay attention to. And so I think the MAGA movement, if you have Marjorie Taylor Greene, who's already, you know, fallen out with Trump, if you have her saying that this is not aligned with the movement, the MAGA movement, then I think you've got some real problems with your base. But we'll see how that shakes out. It's only a matter of time. If the United States does have to get more involved in Venezuela in order to make sure that the oil is pumping or that the country isn't plunged into revolution, then I think you're going to see real upset in America, because that's going to cost a lot of money and a lot of time.
We're enjoying our conversation with historian, author, and public speaker, Dr. Michael Patrick Cullinane, the Walton Chair of Theodore Roosevelt Studies at Dickinson State University. Dr. Cullinane, on Facebook, we've seen a lot of things about this, but the one, I guess, comment that has stood out to me is, do we not have a Congress? So the question becomes, what is the war powers framework relative to what we have seen happen here in Venezuela?
Okay, so the war powers resolution that was passed in the wake of the Watergate scandal basically reasserted congressional power over war making, right? So we know in Article 1 of the Constitution, where Congress's powers are outlined, it says that Congress has the power to make war, right? That kind of is undercut by the second article of the Constitution, which allows the president to defend the country as commander in chief. So Congress and the president have done a tightrope act, particularly in the 20th century, over this power. And when the president ran away with these powers during the Vietnam War, Congress tried to claw them back with what's called the War Powers Resolution. And that means that the president has to notify Congress of any military intervention or action that's taken, and that if Congress doesn't approve of that intervention within 60 or 90 days, then the action needs to be stopped. And the problem with that is that the action is over, right? I mean, you know, the president can take unilateral action without letting Congress know. Marco Rubio came out and said that the reason why they didn't tell Congress people about the abduction of Maduro was because they're known to leak. And so therefore we shouldn't tell them. And this is an excuse that lots of presidents have made, saying that, you know, to protect American security and the surprise of an attack, you know, they can't tell anybody. And so this is effectively dead in the water. The War Powers Resolution doesn't really come into effect here, because unless the United States is going to build a nation like they did in Iraq, in Venezuela, they're not going to be there for 60 days. This action's already done.
Found it fascinating that both were learning this morning, the New York Times and the Washington Post knew of this invasion prior and withheld their reporting to protect American troops. So the point is that there are leaks, and in this case and in other cases as well, the media has actually played a role in assisting the administration. I found that fascinating. What's next here relative to the United States? We've heard now that President Trump say, well, if they do what we want them to do, then things will be fine. And if they don't, then there's going to be more trouble. Again, it all leads back to oil in my mind. What are you thinking?
Well, it's a very messy situation. So what we've got here is a classic power vacuum. It happened when Saddam Hussein left Iraq or was extracted from Iraq by U.S. forces. And it happens elsewhere when you have this really tumultuous, effectively overthrow. What's currently happening now is that the Venezuela Constitution is kicking into effect and the vice president of Venezuela has been named the interim president. But the vice president, contrary to what Marco Rubio and Donald Trump had said in the press conference, that they asserted that she was working with the U.S. administration. Contrary to that, she's come out and said that she wants people to take to the streets and to resist, and she wants proof of life of Maduro, and she wants Maduro back. Now, some people are saying this is grandstanding, that she has to do this in order to appease the people of Venezuela, and that the administration know that she's gonna take this hard line. In reality, that could be true. The other thing that's really interesting is that she has been the leading force behind modernizing the oil industry in Venezuela over the last decade. So she's in a prime position to help the administration extract oil from Venezuela. The problem with all of this is that the opposition leader, who's exiled and who's recently won a Nobel Peace Prize, is not being included in this. The Venezuelan people are not being included because, remember, the government of Maduro is illegitimate. You know, the vice president, the president, all of this is based on a sham. So self-determination and democracy are not playing out here. And the truth be told, I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, what has happened in situations like this in the past, is revolution, long-term unsettled politics. And I don't think, we're going to see the oil industry in Venezuela pump its capabilities for another decade to come, despite the investment that will start coming after Maduro's exit.
And then the question is the president said last night, the United States maybe will subsidize this. And there are some discussions on whether that can happen as well. After a major foreign policy action like this happens, what tends to follow politically? It seems to me we certainly aren't going to see any rally around the flag support, maybe even not any backlash from this at all. Life for us here is just going to go on for a while. What does history suggest?
Well, I think, past American interventions, U.S. interventions in Latin American countries have not worked out the way people wanted or expected. Certainly the way an administration wanted or expected. So Venezuela's got real allies in the world, powerful allies, Russia, China, Iran. These are not small powers that the United States can push around. China and Russia are going to have, we're seeing this play out now with oil tankers that are fleeing Venezuela, but also local, as in, Western hemispheric countries are pushing back against this. Anyone with a left-leaning president or leadership like Brazil, right? Lula da Silva, the president of Brazil, is pushing back on this. We could see Brazil under Lula, shut off trade with the United States. There's other countries with right-wing governments that are then hugely supportive of this, whether it's Chile or elsewhere. But the problem is that this sort of like fracturing of relations within Latin America has never been a positive for the United States, although many administrations have welcomed that, because what it's meant is that South American and Central American countries don't have a singular voice, which benefits the United States, frankly. Well, I think what we can see is this sort of disjointed and multipolar nature of hemispheric relations for a while to come.
And now, of course, we've heard Cuba and Colombia kind of being brought into the discussions here. And from a historical standpoint as well, what are the risks of a doctrine that starts with one exception, Venezuela, and then expands region-wide?
Well, I think the problem is it's not an exception. I mean, Trump has been pushing for right-wing politicians to take power all throughout Latin America, whether it's Bolsonaro in Brazil, whether it's Milei in Argentina, and vice versa. There's a pushback. You've got Sheinbaum in Mexico who's pushing back. I mean, the reality is if there is a critical mass of left-wing anti-Trump governments in Latin America, that's a really bad thing for the United States, because it means that migrants, drug running, genuinely bad criminal actions can continue to happen. I don't think antagonizing Latin American countries is the way you go to win them over. And if we go to our history books in the 1930s, the Hoover and Franklin Roosevelt administrations created the Good Neighbor Policy as a means of trying to put right decades of military interventions that did not work. So, I mean, we can look to countries like Nicaragua, Haiti, Honduras. These countries were put under the thumb of the United States for decades. And as a result, they've never really had an opportunity to grow out of that space.
As we kind of zoom out this morning, what is, I guess, acceptable or permissible for presidents, their role in foreign policy of either party, has it changed over the weekend?
I don't think it's changed over the weekend. I have to say this, Craig, in all honesty, I think if Trump made a play for Greenland that involved a military action, that would change everything. Like, I think our world would be turned upside down if that were to happen. The taking of Maduro does have historical precedent. It's got legal, some sort of very flimsy, but nevertheless, a grounding in American legal system. And there's a long track record of American intervention in the Western Hemisphere, our quote unquote backyard, right? But to go against a European ally that's a member of NATO and to break up the global order over what? Minerals, yeah. And a greater role.
Rare earth minerals that are now
exposed. Rare earth minerals and an Arctic strategic policy seems to me like that's a really bad idea.
I have about a minute left. One question that I want to ask you about is this question that we've heard discussed a little bit of head of state immunity in past conflicts. There have been legal arguments, I guess, that have tried to bring that forward. Can they apply here? And what can the U.S. do or choose not to do after an operation like this relative to head of state immunity?
I don't think heads of state should have immunity, if I'm being quite honest. I mean, I think that unfortunately works in both ways as well. That means that American heads of state don't have immunity either to wrongdoing. I mean, we saw at the end of World War II, the Nuremberg trials that brought and would have brought justice to the likes of Hitler, but did bring justice to those like Goering and others that were involved in the Nazi atrocities. I don't think heads of state should be immune from prosecution. I do think how you do it is critically important. Invading a foreign country and extracting a leader is very much different than having an allied, you know, force that's involved in wartime extracting a leader and then trying to bring them to justice. The other thing is we have outlawed, the United States has outlawed the assassination of foreign leaders. And that, I think, is an important distinction to make as well. So look, the ends are okay, but I think the means by which you get to those ends are still important. And that's kind of what makes us American as well. We believe in the rule of law, we believe in democracy, and we believe in due process. And if we start giving that up and saying that our allies don't matter, the process doesn't matter, that we can do whatever we want because we're strong, which is exactly what Stephen Miller said, by the way, this week. He said, the right of might is what is, you know, what's important. If that's all we live by, well, then that might be what we die by too, right? Like, other countries are pretty strong. Do we want to get into a fight with them?
Who has the big stick? My guest has been Dr. Michael Patrick Cullinane, professor of history at Dickinson State University. He shares his passion with us periodically here on Main Street, and we're grateful for that. Thanks for joining us again today on Main Street.
Thanks, Greg.
Still ahead on today's Main Street, another Plainsfolk essay from our good friend Dr. Tom Easern, and we'll then turn to agriculture and hemp's modern resurgence and the federal policy that could abruptly shut down its most profitable markets. That and more is ahead. Stay with us. Main Street continues on this Tuesday. I'm Craig Blumenschein. A sudden winter storm can stir up old stories and old songs. In today's Plainsfolk, historian Dr. Tom Easern follows a favorite cold weather ballad into the mailbox and into the curious history of a tiny figure known as the Frozen Charlotte.
A dangerous storm has swept in today, a harsh coda to a two-day Chinook that caused us to let our guard down. It puts me in mind of a favorite ballad of mine for the season, Young Charlotte. Young Charlotte lived on the mountainside in a wild and lonely spot. There were no cabins for 3 miles wide except her father's cot. And yet on many a winter's night, young swains would gather there, for her father kept a social board, and she was very fair. Recall of these lines sends me into the storm to the mailbox, wherein I find a package that has come by virtue of online commerce containing a bizarre little artifact, a frozen Charlotte. Its story has to do with the ballad ringing in my head, but it goes back farther. A quick plot summary of the ballad. Young Charlotte is dead set on attending a New Year's ball 20 miles away, despite the fearful cold and her mother's warning to wrap up warmly. The carriage ride is miserable. Charlotte falls silent and, on arrival at the ballroom, is found to be frozen stiff. On the surface, this is sort of a cautionary tale on two counts. Listen to your mother, and don't disregard the dangers of winter. Tracing the lineage of the ballad, we find it originates with an 1843 poem, A Corpse Going to a Ball, by a popular writer from Maine, Seba Smith. He writes of Charlotte's demise. He took her hand in his. Oh, God, 'twas cold and hard as stone. He tore the mantle from her face. The cold stars on her shone. Then, quickly, to the lighted hall, her voiceless form he bore. Young Charlotte was a stiffened corpse, and word spoke never more. The poet Smith took inspiration from a New York newspaper report that first appeared the 1st of January, 1840, and spread via newspaper exchange. The story of an unnamed girl, it said, up here in the country, who died on the way to a ball, like in the ballad. The story closes, he spoke to her, but she answered not. She was dead, stone dead, frozen stiff, a corpse on the way to the ball. The story has no confirmation or specifics. The poet juices it up, and balladry scooped it into oral tradition. Such a tragic story. People are often uncomfortable with it or ascribe blame. The first thing to remember, though, is that the story was bogus from the beginning, a fictitious filler of column inches, then grist for a pulp poet. The second thing to remember is, although some singers treat the ballad seriously as a morality play, that is not the historic sense of it. The ballad is a farce, a parody, sung by young people at play parties and other places where they could sing it, feign horror, and roll their eyes at the mother's admonitions. The proof of such attitudes, the frozen Charlotte. A little white porcelain or bisque figure, mine is just over an inch long, the frozen Charlotte, which would be baked into a cake as a game and a party favor. I do not plan to bake my frozen Charlotte into a cake. I do plan, however, to exhibit it whenever I sing her ballad to assuage the potential grief of listeners.
What began as a grim winter warning turns out to be something closer to parody and play. Tom Ezern's plainsfolk essay, Frozen Charlotte, reminds us that even the coldest tales carry a wink, a song, and a story meant to be shared.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by North Dakota Living, celebrating 70 years of featuring the great people and places of North Dakota, and proudly serving the members of North Dakota's electric cooperatives.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Hemp is back in American fields in a big way. After years of shrinking acreage, farmers planted more than 45,000 acres nationwide last year, betting on a crop that found new life after the 2018 Farm Bill. But now, just as hemp farming rebounds, a proposed federal ban on most hemp-derived THC products could upend the industry, threatening processors, retailers, and the farmers who depend on its most profitable markets. Harvest Public Media's Molly Ashford reports on what's at stake and why many in the industry are racing against the clock for a fix.
Inside the warehouse of the Sweetwater Hemp Company in rural Nebraska, Brett Mayo opens a giant bag of raw hemp that just arrived from a nearby farm.
So this is bucked dry CBD. So like I said, we can
Mayo
bring
it is the chief extraction officer at Sweetwater, which grows hemp and produces hemp-derived products. That includes Delta 9 gummies that mimic the effects of marijuana. Others, like tinctures and ointments, are used primarily for pain relief. Mayo says the vast majority of Sweetwater's products could become illegal in November.
Nobody really knew it was coming. It came in very late.
Lawmakers snuck a provision to close the hemp loophole into the bill that ended the longest government shutdown in American history. It was an unlikely vehicle for the changes that some lawmakers have been seeking for years. Jonathan Miller is an attorney representing advocacy group U.S. Hemp Roundtable.
We've been worried about this for quite some time. It's worked its way through the process and finally was added on to this bill.
The current law limits the amount of THC that's allowed in hemp-derived products. But those limits were based on the weight of products, and companies could still create intoxicating edibles, gummies, and drinks. The new provisions would cap the amount of THC per container at 0.4 milligrams. Miller says these new limits would crush the booming hemp extract industry.
That would encompass 95% of the hemp extract industry. 95% products, even the vast majority of non-intoxicating CBD products, have more than 0.4 milligrams of THC per container.
The changes could also hurt farmers who grow hemp. A U.S. Department of Agriculture report found hemp acreage increased significantly in 2024. Not all hemp is used for extraction. Fiber hemp is used for goods like building materials and insulation. Cynthia Cabrera, the president of the Texas Hemp Business Council, says while fiber hemp is becoming more popular, it's not as lucrative.
Everyone loves the idea of, you know, hemp world, where all the sidewalks are made out of hemp and all the houses are made out of hemp. Realistically, however, that is in the future. And what keeps the farmers in business right now in terms of hemp crop is that they are able to use them for the finished goods industry.
So while hemp is primarily used for extraction in most states, fiber hemp is the focus in South Dakota. Ken Meyer, a co-owner of Complete Hemp Processing in South Dakota, says that's largely because the state has been building up processing capacity.
When there's not enough processing to keep up with what the farmers can produce, then there's not a good market for the farmers to make sure they're paid for their crop.
The hemp fiber industry shouldn't be impacted by the pending restrictions, but Meyer is still concerned. He says the changes could discourage farmers from adding hemp to their rotations because of confusion or fear, and that could trickle down into important aspects of hemp farming like banking and insurance.
If the message is being heard that this ban on hemp is in place and we're kind of lumped in with it, with some people's view, it might cause interest, capital to not come into hemp.
But despite all the concern, nearly everyone in the hemp industry expects Congress will soften the restrictions. Some legislation to do so has already been introduced. Mayo of Sweetwater Hemp says he'd be shocked if the law stands as written.
I don't think it's going to be eliminated. It's just not feasible that you're going to get rid of your multi-billion dollar business and the taxes and everything that it brings in, especially since the administration that made it legal took it away.
Without action, the ban will take effect on November 12th.
As lawmakers debate how to regulate hemp-derived THC, farmers and producers are left navigating uncertainty, caught between a booming market and a possibility of sweeping prohibition. With planting decisions looming and supply chains still taking shape, the future of hemp may hinge not on whether it's grown, but how it's defined in law. That story was from Harvest Public Media's Molly Ashford.
The FM Symphony presents Masterworks 3, Symphonic Giants, January 17th and 18th. The program includes Dvorak's Slavonic Dances with the Area Youth Symphony and pianist Tyler Wattridge performing St. Sane's Piano Concerto No. 2. Information at fmsymphony.org.
It's Michelle Martin. Every weekday morning, my Morning Edition co-host and I have some questions.
What do you say to that concern from voters that there needs to
be... Can this squarely be laid on the feet of the government shutdown, or are there deeper problems?
Do you agree it's important for government officials to be truthful before Congress?
Get information, context, accountability on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition, weekdays from 4 to 9 a.m. Central on Prairie Public.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Researchers from the University of Hawaii at Manoa are using Okinawan songs to learn about climate and geology. Justin Higa is a postdoctoral fellow and a traditional music practitioner. Our Living Lands producer Daniel Spalding spoke to Higa about the connections between climate, music, and culture.
Can you share about the research and what you've learned along the way?
Yeah, so I've been playing this genre of UQ and indigenous classical music for over 10 years. Our central art is UQ and classical music. So we play the three-stringed instrument called a sanshin. It's basically a lute with a snakeskin covering. But more important than playing is the singing. So working with my sensei, my teachers, we talked about how a lot of the songs that we sing in traditional Okinawa music, UQ and music, they talk about the natural world around us a lot, the environment. And we learned that a couple of the songs that we sing very often hold knowledge of the climate, ocean systems, and geology, and how people interacted with them hundreds of years ago.
Can you share a little bit about the songs and the significance behind them?
The two songs that we analyzed in this project are called Nubui Kuduchi and Kudai Kuduchi. Nubui just means going up, so basically the journey north from Okinawa to southern Japan. And Kudai means going down, so going south from southern Japan by boat back home to the Okinawan islands. And this song talks about when Ryukyuan or Okinawan envoys had to send tribute to southern Japan after they were taken over by Japan and basically became a vassal state of the Satsuma domain of southern Japan. So the songs talk about the prayers they made before going on the journey, tears shed with family because they knew it was a difficult voyage, leaving the port from the boats and the perfect winds from specific directions and times of year. Then you go into the open ocean, describing specific areas that were particularly rough, had very rough ocean currents. Then when you get closer to southern Japan, the volcanoes that were seen erupting, and then finally the joy at seeing land after making this very difficult journey away from home. And then the opposite is true coming back home, where it's a lot happier of a song. And there's a lot of celebration. They go through the same ocean conditions, but they are welcomed back home with open arms, and people are gathering at the port to see these people back home. So understanding how our ancestors interacted with climate and geology through these ocean voyages and relating it to science and observations, it's, we hope that that can make our art relevant to life today and kind of a cool way to show people what we do.
What would you say the significance would be in this study, and why does it matter to, you know, us today?
It's been a real privilege to bring my culture and my background into the geoscience and the climate science that I do for a living, studying landslides and earthquakes and how that kind of stuff affects living people. And my sensei would express it in the opposite direction, where we want to expose more people to our art and revive what we have left because of the history of suppression of our culture in the past, and being able to bring that back in many different ways through performing, through science, through climate science work, show that both the science and the culture and the art are relevant and they're not separate. I think that's the main takeaway that we want to convey.
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Kelly Corrigan Wonders. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
Revenge scorn? Trump cancels a water pipeline in Colorado. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Last week, President Trump exercised the first veto of his second term by canceling a clean water project in Colorado that had been approved unanimously by the House and the Senate.
The project is already under construction, and the legislation would have eased the repayment terms for the communities that will use it.
The development includes a 130-mile pipeline to provide clean water for municipal and industrial uses, serving about 50,000 people in the southeastern part of Colorado, located in congressional districts that voted heavily for Trump.
Many communities in the area have been waiting for the project for decades because they've been relying on groundwater that can contain salt, radium, and uranium, which require expensive treatment or alternatives like bottled water.
In his veto message to Congress, Trump said that he was committed to saving American taxpayers from expensive and unreliable policies and ending handouts. However, the Congressional Budget Office estimated that the project would have an effect on direct spending of less than $500,000.
Trump then signaled that his veto may have been about politics. In a social media post, he referred to Colorado's Governor Jared Polis as a scumbag and wished that he and the prosecutor who brought a criminal case against the former county clerk Tina Peters would rot in hell. The governor has refused to release Peters from prison, who was convicted for allowing unauthorized access to state voting machines.
The water project legislation was sponsored by Colorado Republican Congress member Lauren Boebert, who represents a district where a major part of the pipeline is situated. She said that the effort to keep the project going was not over.
Boebert added that she hoped the veto had nothing to do with political retaliation for demanding accountability in an apparent reference to the release of the Epstein files. Trump had unsuccessfully pressured Boebert to vote against the release last November.
Now, an ode to clouds. These collections of water and ice float above us, and on any given day, we barely give them much thought. Yet they have a weighty influence on making Earth a habitable place, providing us with fresh water, shading us from the sun, and regulating global climate.
New research suggests that we might want to give clouds their due. In a paper presented at a meeting of the American Geophysical Union last month, George Saloudis, a climate scientist at NASA, said that the world's reflective cloud cover has shrunk in the past two decades, allowing in more light and boosting global warming.
In his research based on 35 years of satellite data, Saloudis found that subtropical zones where fewer clouds occur have expanded. This is worrisome because in these areas close to the equator, it will allow more solar energy to hit the Earth's surface year-round.
In contrast, Earth's cloudiest zones over the oceans, which typically cool the planet, have shifted toward the poles and shrunk, allowing more of the sun's energy to reach and warm the seas.
Because of increased human-caused greenhouse gases, Earth has a growing energy imbalance, where the planet is absorbing more solar radiation than it reflects back into space.
These new findings suggest that the loss of reflective oceanic storm clouds is a significant driver of that imbalance. Climate scientists like Saloudis will next investigate whether greenhouse gases have caused cloud coverage to change and if we should expect the trend to continue. And finally, we think of evolution as a slow, lumbering process of changes in traits across generations. But don't tell that to a group of sparrows living on the UCLA campus in Southern California.
A new study has found that offspring of dark-eyed juncos, a type of sparrow, developed longer bills during the COVID-19 pandemic when lockdowns were imposed.
Juncos have historically lived in mountain forests near Southern California, but because of climate change and habitat loss, many birds moved into urban areas, such as around UCLA in the early 2000s.
Juncos in the wild have long bills to help them dig and forage for bugs and seeds, but the urban birds developed short, stubby beaks because That's all they needed to pick up food scraps, crumbs, and other morsels left by people.
How quickly could they evolve their anatomy? Now we know. Researchers at UCLA say that when everyone went into lockdown during the pandemic, the easy snacks left by students and staff disappeared. So the urban birds were forced to forage in shrubbery and grasses like their cousins in the mountains do.
In an example of survival of the fittest, the juncos that still had slightly longer bills got more bugs and seeds and were able to survive and have babies. The team says that during the 2 years of reduced human activity during COVID, juncos were born with longer beaks.
Remarkably, that adaptation didn't last. Once campus life went back to normal, the bills in youngsters returned to the previous shorter shape, underscoring the effect that humans can have on wildlife.
Given that an estimated 3 billion birds have vanished over the past 50 years, of which about 6% are juncos, this evolutionary versatility offers hope for their survival.
That's it for this week in Water. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
This is Dakota Datebook for January 6th. North Dakota's old Capitol Building in Bismarck, built in 1884, was home to state officials, including the governor, the secretary of state, and the attorney general. It was also where the two houses of the state legislature met. By the early 1900s, the building was showing its age. The exterior was brick, but the interior was primarily wood. With all the walls, floors, and stairways in a large building, there was a great deal of wood. Concern about the possibility of fire grew so serious that records and documents were kept in fireproof storage cabinets. The concern about fire was ongoing. On this date in 1915, Representative J. L. Yort appealed to his fellow legislators to take the danger very seriously. He said the lack of safety features threatened anyone who worked in or visited the Capitol. Yort urged lawmakers to approve the installation of fire escapes for both the Assembly and Senate chambers. Yort reminded legislators that they themselves had passed laws regulating fire protection in public places, but those laws apparently did not apply to the Capitol. He told them, in the very hall in which emanated these same laws and regulations, no protection whatsoever for life and safety was thought of for those legislators who enacted these laws. Yort noted that nothing had happened so far and that every legislator who attended sessions had left the building safely. But he warned that this does not constitute any guarantee whatever that a most frightful loss of life in case of a fire might not occur at any moment. He urged the legislature to approve fire escapes to improve the safety of the building. Despite his impassioned speech, the legislators were not convinced. The building was equipped with fire extinguishers and fire hoses on the upper floors, but fire escapes were never installed. And then it happened. On the morning of December 28, 1930, smoke was spotted coming from the northeast portion of the building. Fortunately, it was about 7:30 in the morning. The building was empty, and no fire escapes were needed. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
A year ago, wildfires devastated parts of Southern California. Some residents then spent months battling with insurance companies.
I was on the verge of leaving money on the table just to move forward.
The challenges of getting insurance payouts after a disaster. On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
And that's it for this Tuesday's Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, the University of North Dakota has reached a milestone as Anthony A.J. Lake has become its first graduate of the FAA's Enhanced Air Traffic Controller Training Program. We'll visit with A.J. to see where his accelerated pathway will take him. And that's tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us again.